Schilling, I want you, this breaking news out of Fox. If we put it up in Denver, I'd appreciate it, the story. The Secretary of Education requested the letter. So they've lied and misrepresented. Requested the letter from the School Board Association to go to Jess about domestic terrorism. Tell us about this.
Steve, this was an inside job, right? This was collusion at the highest level of our government. And it wasn't just collusion against America. It was collusion against the American people. Makes it so much worse. What we saw during this last summer was a very normal democratic process of parents being outraged after finding out what their kids were learning in schools. And so they showed up. And there was one instance where a father had an outrage and was arrested. But guess what? That father's daughter was raped in the bathroom, and the school board covered it up. And that was the impetus for why Miguel Cardona petitioned and solicited this letter from the National Association of School Boards to the Department of Justice to investigate these parents for domestic abuse. A father who had his daughter be sexually assaulted in the bathroom, getting arrested, was the impetus for here. This is a government that hates its people. It despises us. It views us as the enemy. Steve, I'm kind of upset that you stopped, with the rant there earlier. You were on point. We have a government in place. We have a regime in place that hates its very own people. They view us as the enemy and not anyone else. And this is as Tucker Carlson pointed out, the war on terror 2.0.
So, welcome to Straight Talk with MJ. I'm your host, Michelle Jeanette. And I had to put that clip at the beginning because today we're talking about with a man who is running for school board here in our county. And this was very appropriate because if you've been paying attention or maybe you've been watching the news the last year, parents have become the enemy, especially with school boards. And I think because of the school closures and doing school online, parents kind of found out what their kids were learning and were very upset about it. So from everything from critical race to the sexualization of our children, it's creeping in, and it's a widespread in a lot of areas. Now, granted, here in our county, it's not near as bad as some of these other big counties and big cities. But it's important to understand what our government is doing and how they view you, the parent. Right now, you, the parent, has been labeled domestic terrorism. How do you feel about that? So just because you want to go and take back control of what your kids are learning, you're the enemy. So what can we do about it? We get involved locally. We speak up. Parents start speaking up. We start holding everyone accountable, because we're the ones in this constitutional republic. A lot of people like to say we're a democracy. We are not a democracy. We are a constitutional republic. We have representatives. We, the people, are the ones in charge. We, the people, give a few representatives the authority to do certain things, and they have definitely stepped beyond that authority. So we're going to, you know, getting involved is extremely important. And I just wanted to bring that little clip to you to maybe you didn't know about it. So maybe you didn't know what the government, the current government views parents and some school boards. So the importance of getting involved can't be overstated. So I have an interview today with Mr. Doug Ibbotson. He is running for school board in District 1, and we're going to talk a little bit about what his views are, and hopefully parents will get involved and this word will get out, and we'll just keep everyone accountable. When you keep people accountable, things run better. All right, so listen to the interview, and with my podcast, if you're new to my podcast, I always end with tidbits or stories or information from our great American history. And I will do that today, and hope you enjoy that. And if you want more of this or more information about the history and things like that, you can always go to my website, straighttalkwithmj.net, and have all my podcast episodes there listed under the blog page. and you can listen to those. Lots of interviews and lots of discussion about various topics over the last couple years. This is my third year now. So enjoy the conversation with Mr. Doug Ibbotson, and I'll see you at the end of that with a little bit of history. Okay, we're here with Doug Ibbotson.
Ibbotson.
And he's running for school board. I wanted to come sit down and talk with him about his campaign. And so first off, we're going to ask, give us a little background, because one of the things I noticed when we moved here, and you talked about it before when you moved here, is you don't really know much about the people in some of the local positions, for instance, like school board. And there's not any website or anything like that that you can go to that tells you about them. So give us a little background of where you're from and how you got here.
Sure. Well, first of all, thanks for having me, you know, on your webcast. I appreciate it. Again, my name is Doug Ibbotson, and I'm a candidate for the District 1 school board seat here in Jefferson County. The campaign, you know, is going on right now, and hopefully will resume in my winning one of those seats on May 3rd of 2022. When we came here, we've been here about 9 years. In 2022, well, I guess we are in 2022. It'll be about 10 years. I've been kind of all over the place. I've lived in very, very liberal states. I've lived in very, very conservative states. I'm a Westerner. All right, I say I was born in the West, but brought to Tennessee by the grace of God. We found our home. We love it here, and we're going to be here for the rest of our life. What I am is I was conceived. I was in the oven when my dad was in the Navy, and I popped out of the oven after my dad got discharged from the Navy. And at that point, he was at the Naval Shipyards in Long Beach, California. He went to work for his grandfather, who was a developer in a little town called Bellflower, California. Bellflower, named that because it was named after the tulip, because it was all Dutch people with dairy farms out there.
Wow.
So as a matter of fact, the city insignia was, it said Bellflower below with a tulip, with a cow sitting on top.
Oh, that's interesting.
So
I didn't know that was
Dutch
there.
Dutch dairy farmers, very, very conservative area. My dad was a very conservative man. I was raised back in California, back in the day when California, even though it was left-leaning, it was pretty much like every other state.
Right.
As a matter of fact, he was appointed to the State Water Board and the State Real Estate Procurement Commission by Ronald Reagan.
Ah,
and he served in that position all throughout Reagan's 8 years of his governorship, and then was brought back by the two following Republican governors, a gentleman who you don't hear much about, but he was a very effective conservative governor of California called George Duke Majan. And after that, Pete Wilson, who was the Republican mayor of San Diego before he became the governor. Well, my dad became closer and closer and closer with all of those conservative governors, to the point where two of the three that were still alive were at his funeral when he passed away.
Wow.
So needless to say, I was raised very, very Republican, very, very conservative. And even though people hear I'm from California, it's not the California that you think of now. It was the California of Ronald Reagan and
right.
George Duke Majan and all of them. I went to school at St. John's College. And I was majoring in theology at the time. I decided to leave there and go to New York University, where I met my wife, who I will be married 49 years with her as of this year. I stayed back there, completed my Bachelor of Arts degree in anthropology with a minor in theology. We stayed back there while she finished up her nursing school, and she became an emergency room nurse, which she has been for some 30 some odd years. After we both graduated, we went back to California because my family was there. I got involved in corporate America. Mm-hmm. I became a marketing executive for Safeco Title Insurance Company.
Yeah.
And in that position, I stayed for about 15 years and left Safeco Title Insurance as a senior vice president in charge of their agency operations for the Western United States. After I left there, I went with a bank. A bank felt that I could help them in their acquisition of trust funds that a lot of labor unions, a lot of real estate firms have and things of that nature, and they're very lucrative to a bank because they get to hold them and not pay interest on them. So I went there, I formed a trust division for them, and after 15 years with them, I decided to leave, and at that point I was a senior vice president in charge of their total trust department.
So you knew a lot about economics, finance, all that kind of stuff.
I do. I've looked at lots of balance sheets. I've looked at lots of general ledgers. I've said yes to a lot of loans, and I've declined a lot of loans. People who say numbers don't lie don't know what they're talking about. You could have the number four mean the number four. You could have a number four mean the depreciated number four. You could have the number four mean anything you want it to mean, and it's up to an experienced financial man to know what he's looking at,
right,
and to be able to discern what budgets say and what general ledgers mean. We'll be getting into that a little bit later on. After that, I decided that I'd had enough of corporate America and that I really wanted to strike out on my own. I'm an avid fisherman. I love to fish. My wife has always thought about having a bed and breakfast, so we said, well, maybe we ought to do a fishing lodge somewhere. And we were thinking of Maine or Wyoming or Montana, you know, places like this. So I left corporate America, and we started looking around. After about 2 years, I said, well, maybe the man upstairs is saying this isn't what we're supposed to do, because we just couldn't find the right place. Finally, I was in British Columbia at a lodge that we went up to look at, and we decided it wasn't what we wanted. And a little voice saying, why don't you look in Alaska? I go, Alaska, of course, the fishing, hunting mecca of the North America.
No kidding.
We went up there, looked at a couple lodges, found one that was just beautiful, but it had been mismanaged. And based upon my experience, I said, we could turn this around. So we bought it. We went up there and just kind of by the seat of our pants, we started building and formatting something called the Boardwalk Wilderness Lodge. We spent 12 years up there. While we were up there, it became the third best rated fishing lodge in North America by Condé Nast and a lot of just objective viewpoints. It was a small lodge, but we had 99% rebookings. People would book before they leave for the following year because they're afraid there wouldn't be a place up there. So needless to say, I think I know business.
Right.
This is what I can bring to the people of Jefferson County, and this is what I can bring to the school board and the school district.
So that's a great segue into running for school board, and it's because Tennessee passed the bipartisan, you know, making school board races bipartisan. And so what motivated you to run for school board here in Jefferson County?
It's interesting. When I decided to run for school board, it was because I always believe in giving something back to my community, whatever community I've been in. When I came to East Tennessee 9 years ago, you know, I'm a musician. I play a banjo. And I started a jam session primarily to fill in the winter months when a lot of the outdoor jam sessions that go on in the park stop. Mm-hmm. So I figured, well, let me start one up if I can find an indoor venue where, you know, musicians can come and people can come and listen. We found the Indian Creek Deli.
Oh, yeah.
All right. We had the jam session down there. It became so popular that after the winter months, the musicians didn't want me to stop it, and the audience didn't want me to stop it, so it kept on going for 3 years.
We were at one of those. That's pretty cool.
Now, from that, I met a bunch of good musicians and a lot of very good-hearted people, many of whom were retired. And we said, you know, why don't we do something where we can give back to our community by taking the, you know, we had a fiddle player, a mandolin player, I was a banjo player, we had a bass player, a lot of guitar players. And we says, what we can do is we can go out and we can get underprivileged kids who may otherwise not be exposed to this kind of music and who don't have the kind of money they need to buy instruments. We can bring them in, lend them instruments, give them lessons for free. And at that point, we didn't know how we were going to do this. But at the end of 5, 6, 7 lessons, if we feel that they are really into this, we can actually give them the instruments that we lent them to practice on.
Yeah.
So we started something called the Pee Wee Pickers of Jefferson County. And to date, and that's, it's still going on. And to date, we have graduated about 75 different kids. And graduation means they are recognized with the certificate of recognition. They are actually awarded the instrument that they've been practicing on, all right? And we try and get them together for jams so they can continue playing with each other and developing.
Wow.
It's been a great success. We've actually had 2 people come from out of state, one from Elko, Nevada, and one from Monterey, California, come and start chapters of Pee Wee Pickers
in their place.
Now, it's not an organized, nonprofit thing. We don't want to do that because we don't want the government coming in and saying, if you're taking money, you got to do this and you got to do that. So it's a very loosely organized thing, but it's been tremendously successful. Getting back to your question, why I decided I wanted to run for school board, what we found out is a lot of our kids, more and more, were saying that this was the first time they'd been exposed to the, you know, Appalachian type music, and the parents are saying the reason why that is we don't have them going to public schools. We're homeschooling them. This is actually our fine arts course requirement that we're fulfilling by bringing them here because we homeschool our kids.
A lot of homeschoolers.
And I started asking, well, why are you homeschooling your kids? What's wrong with the Jefferson County schools? And I got an earload. I got an earful when I asked that question. Everything from the kids are not getting the attention they need. They are getting held back because other students are, you know, it's kind of like No Child Left Behind. A lot of federal and state things. So I said, you know, I want to find out a little bit more about this because we were getting more and more kids in who were homeschooled. They were coming all the way from Merrillville. They were coming from Hamlin County. They were coming from Jefferson. They were coming from everywhere. So I started going to, I went to a school board meeting and I sat there. I didn't go with any agenda. I just wanted to see what a school board meeting was like. And there was no parents there, or virtually no parents there. There was, you know, even though there was a public, you know, comment period in the beginning, nobody commented publicly. And it was probably the most bland, boring thing I've ever been to. One of the 2 parents that was there, because their kids were getting awarded with some kind of an award from the school district. I said, are the school district meetings always this boring? He says, yeah, always. And I said, why? And he says, let me tell you. He says, I've been coming to the school board, you know, and my kids, I've got 6 kids. They've all gone to Jefferson County Schools. Jefferson County Schools used to be very dynamic. They used to be very involved. They used to be very parent teacher oriented, where there was kind of a cooperation between the two. He says, that's not the case anymore. Right now, it's almost like people come to the school board and the rules are you can talk for up to 3 minutes at the beginning of the meeting. You cannot ask the school board any questions and they cannot address any questions to you. So once you said your 3 minutes, what's the reason to stand there? They're going to do what they're going to do, whether you want them to do it or not. And the next time you have to comment is the next meeting, and all you're doing is commenting on what went on in the last meeting, whether you agreed with it or not. But by then, it's too late to do anything about it because it's already been done.
Right.
And I said, well, that's crazy. He said, well, that's the rules. So I said, that's nutty. So I went to a few more, and at those, at one meeting, I spoke, and it had to do with the building, whether we should build a new school.
I think we were at that one. That might have been where we met you.
I think it might have been. And I noticed I was up there, and everybody, and there were more people there at that meeting than the first one, just because, it was a hotter subject. And I got a lot of attention from the audience, both pro and con. It was like the school board just sat there, and it was like they just, drank a cup of warm milk. It was like I didn't, okay, next, yeah. Next. And I said at that point, something's got to quit here. So I decided at that point that I could maybe make a statement and help the Jefferson County schools by becoming a member of the school board and bringing some business expertise and some parent participation back to the school board.
Okay, so what are some of the ideas you would be bringing to?
What I'm bringing, my platform is pretty simple. I don't believe in complicated.
Yeah.
People make things too complicated. Yeah. To me, as a businessman, and this has always worked both in the corporate America and in my personal business. You identify a problem. You come to a solution to that problem, and you execute the solution, and you move on to the next problem. People make things so very difficult, and the more people you have involved, the more difficult they make it. Mm. So my whole idea is to bring fiscal responsibility and business acumen to our school board. To me, a school board is like a board of directors. Mm-hmm. A board of directors at a company sets the policy of the company, sets the personality of the company, sets the future goals of the company, and evaluates the progress of that company on an ongoing basis. That's what a school board should be doing to the school district who are appointed.
Okay.
They need to set the personality by hiring the right people. They need to set the goals and make sure that the people who are appointed are following those goals. They need to evaluate the progress that those goals are, how those goals are being accomplished. And they need to reward those who achieve the goal and penalize those who are not doing that. Right now, I feel that our school board, by and large, are good people. They have all said, we are giving of our time, we have given of our time to better the education in Jefferson County. But there are certain people on that school board who've been there so long that I think they've lost sight of what the school board is supposed to be. Mm-hmm. And I don't care how long, what kind of business, what kind of service that you're giving. If you're on a school board for 20 years, you don't look at that responsibility the same as you did day one when you went on there. Oftentimes, complacency comes in, and people just rubber stamp things that come down from the people that they've been dealing with because A, they trust those people, or B, they've just lost interest in really what's going on and they're just going through the motions. I'm not saying that's happening with right now, but it is a human tendency that the longer you're in a position, the more complacent you get with what's going on. So my thing is, number one, fiscal responsibility, making certain that any budget, any expenditures, any redirection of monies is looked at thoroughly, systematically, by somebody like me who understands numbers, who understands budgets, and that questions, sometimes sharp questions, sometimes hard questions, are asked of the administrators who are presenting this. That's number one. Number two, I believe that we have to maintain the excellence of our student program. I have no problem with the quality of education, at least from what I've seen and from what I've heard in Jefferson County. Now, this is not my strong suit. I am not a teacher. I have never been on the inside looking out of the school district. So this is something I will have to rely and learn a lot about when I get on the school board. But from what I understand now, compared to surrounding counties, all right, we're in pretty good shape, all right? So, but we have to maintain that excellence. How do we maintain that excellence? We maintain that excellence by maintaining a strong financial background to motor those dreams, those ideals that teachers and students have to their completion. And I see within 3 to 5 years, if we don't rectify the, what I consider, oncoming train wreck that our school district is on the road to financially, those dreams are not going to be able to be achieved by the students and by the teachers. We can get into that. Number two, I believe that parental involvement is absolutely essential. Now, everybody says parental involvement. What do you mean? I think everybody knows what I mean by now by what we've seen on a national picture, where school boards feel that parents are more of a bother than an asset. And I think our school board is beginning to think that way. Whether they, I can't get into their minds. I don't know who set these rules of, that you can't respond or you can't ask questions or be asked questions by parents. My thought is this. Parents need to be at school boards because the education of students begins at the home.
Right.
Parents teach kids what to think. Teachers and the school system teach kids how to think, all right? They do not dictate to kids what their ethics, what their morals, what their values, what their politics, what their religion should be. That is up to the parents. And since the parents set that goal for their kids, they have every right to be involved in a say of how those principles, those issues are being executed at the school system. The way you do that is to have constant contact, constant interaction between teachers, administrators, and school board members, which does not exist in the school district now. I believe that if you're going to have a public forum in the beginning like they have now, that's fine. But parents should be able to ask the school board members questions, and they should be able to ask the parents who are addressing them questions. Also, I believe that before every vote that is taken, now I'm not talking about procedural votes and this kind of stuff, but I'm talking about votes on questions like, fundings, like hirings, like dismissals, I mean, major things that could affect our district.
Even curriculum?
What's that?
Curriculum, maybe?
Curriculum, absolutely. Parents should have, because the way it is now, a vote comes up, the school board members debate it, right? Then they vote on it.
Right.
Parents should have a say, maybe not a vote, but a say, before every one of those votes takes place. So, if we're talking about hiring let's say, if we're talking about whether we should have an elected school superintendent versus an appointed school, I believe we should have an elected school superintendent. But before that vote is taken, you should have a 5 to 10 minute period before that vote where parents can get up and give their opinion on that question, pro and con, all right? It doesn't have to be on, you can limit each parent to a minute of comment so you can get comments in.
Yeah.
But that, at least at that point, you would have school board members voting after hearing from their constituents, hearing immediately from their constituents, not hearsay that Joel said this, said this, said this. They're right there. They're commenting on votes before those votes are taken. And it might make those school board meetings longer, which is fine. But A, parents would stick around because they know they're going to have a say in what's coming up.
Yes.
All right. And they would be interested in listening because they know they're going to have a say on what's coming up.
And that would get them more involved.
Get them more involved.
They think they have a say in it.
They could then engage with their individual school board members after the meeting, before the meeting, knowing this is what's coming up. Also, as a school board member, I would send a survey around to all of my constituents in my district once a quarter, saying these are the questions we're going to be facing in the upcoming school board, you know, let's say the spring session of the school board, all right? Could you give me your opinions on these? Give me your feelings on these. Maybe you can't get to the school board meetings to be there, but at least you can give me as your representative an idea of how I should vote and how you feel.
And I think that because taxpayers are part of this school board, like for when you build a house, you pay taxes towards the schools. We've built now our second home, so we're tax-paying members of and supporting the school board or the school system. So when you say send out surveys to the constituent, you're talking about not just parents. You're talking about everybody.
I'm talking about everybody.
Yeah.
So you know, anybody who wants to be on my survey list.
Right.
All right. I would especially like to hear a parent because they're the ones directly affected.
Absolutely.
You know, but I want to hear both sides.
Yeah.
I'm not looking for somebody just to say, okay, Doug, I agree with you. What a wonderful idea. I want them to say, Doug, you're way off base here. You need to, I'm a businessman. I need to hear both sides of a question so I know where to go because you're not invited, you know, you're electing me to go and use my judgment, but I can't use my judgment unless I know your feelings about things.
Right.
So anybody who would want to be on that survey list, I would somehow get word out, let me know, I'll put you on a blast email. Once a quarter, you're going to get an email from me saying these are the questions that are going to come up in the new term. Let me know your feelings on it. And then I would get back to you and let you know, A, what kind of feedback I got, you know, what the feedback was, and this is how I feel about it, and this is probably based upon what's coming up, how I'll vote on that. If you don't agree with it, let me know.
I think we have one of our kind of frustrations, because we've been going to school board meetings just because we're taxpayers, but there was no way to know what they're talking about. They didn't have it, and you try to find it online. It's really difficult, and if it is, you have to have a password or something to get in to see what their agenda is. You can get from last month's meeting. You know, you can always get the minutes. But
what good is that?
Right.
Those are questions that have already been decided.
Yeah. How do we know what they're going to be talking about or voting on? And when they vote, there's really no discussion between the people unless they've done it some other time, which I don't understand. I thought everything had to be public. I don't know. I may be wrong, but
I've asked people. I said, "When was the last time your school board district representative contacted you proactively without you contacting them?" I haven't had anybody say. Most people don't even know who their school board representative is. Most people don't even know what school district they're in.
Right.
Just because it's a lot easier for school board members just to go to show up. To do their things.
Yeah.
You know, I want active engagement.
Yeah.
That sometimes it's messy, but that's called democracy.
Yeah. So when talking with the curriculum, you know, our Secretary of Education that our governor hired is actually not from Tennessee. She's from Penny Schwinn from UC Berkeley, California. Very liberal, progressive candidate
100%.
There. 100%. Yes. I know our limitations on our curriculum come because of the state gives you options. This is what the state gives you. Here, pick what you know, the state gives you. How can we be proactive in looking, especially when you see on a national level, maybe not so much here yet, I would say yet, put that at the end. You know, this this whole key words of diversity, equity, inclusion, which is really a cover words, or how they like to co-opt the words, for critical race and social emotional learning is also the same thing for the younger kids, where they, some of the Moms for Liberty in Nashville, they had a website where they talked about, they dug into the curriculum and how it's so embedded in the reading materials and everything. How can we be proactive in making sure our kids are not, I guess, making sure they're learning the right things? And you talked about that here a minute ago about, you know, how we teach our kids not what to think in school, but how to think.
I think the way we can, what's been done in the past is pretty much embedded in school districts. And ever since the Department of Education was formed in the 70s, local control of schools has taken a nosedive.
Yeah.
All right. Schools have become school districts have become so reliant on federal and state and outside dollars that pretty much the leverage that the state and the feds have over school districts is unlimited. Mm-hmm. There's not much for anybody to think that's going to change in the near future is naive. Mm-hmm. What we can do, however, is we can start minimizing future monies coming from them by saying, no, we don't agree with that program, so therefore we're not going to accept those dollars. Now, how do we replace those? A politician will say, well, we raise taxes. No, we cut fat. We cut excess. We put a hiring freeze. We start, as people leave or move out of the area, we take those responsibilities and we disperse them within the department. All right. We look at the help wanted list for the school district, which now has 30 some odd names on there. Somehow the school district is getting along fine without those people right now. We say, okay, we are temporarily going to put that on hold. We're going to take those responsibilities again and spread them out within the existing personnel base, all right? By cutting waste and by putting a 10% debt reduction requirement, and this has come from the school district, that for 10 years, a 10-year plan, that every year we are going to require the school district in their budget to reduce our indebtedness by 10%. That means over a 10-year period, we would be out of debt. We would pay off all our obligations. The $3 million in interest that's going out the window and doing nobody any good would be turned back into programs for students, salaries for teachers, salaries for bus drivers, for administrators, etc. We can't do much about the past, but we can start. And everybody's saying, well, I mean, that's just a long term. That's going to take so long. We got to start somewhere.
Yeah.
Nothing that has taken this long to get messed up is going to get fixed overnight.
Yeah.
That's just a reality of business. Let me tell you a story. When I was up in Alaska, we had our fishing lodge. Well, I was in a little town called Thorn Bay. Thorn Bay was a depressed ex-logging camp. It was kind of like a lot of the coal towns in West Virginia. Louisiana Pacific had been virtually the big daddy there. They had, you know, a company store there. They had all their logging operations there, sorting yards, cutting the whole ball of wax. When they left, it left this all of these lumberjacks and logging people in the lurch. They were out of jobs. So what happened is Thorn Bay went from a relatively booming little town to a ghost town. People left, people went on welfare. As a result, but the needs still continued. They still had to have salt for the roads during the winter. They still had to have, you know, road construction. They still had to have schools, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I was you know, at my lodge one day, and I got a call from the head of the town council, a guy named Steve Schell, and he said, Doug, we need help. I said, what do you mean? I said, virtually every one of our suppliers says that they will not supply us with any supplies unless we pay them cash at the time we order. And I said, what? He says, we're 6 months behind on virtually all of our payments to these vendors. And I said, well, I don't blame him. He said, but we've got no way to pay them. I said, okay, let me see what's going on. But I'm going to have some authority to do some things. He says, I'm appointing you to the town council right now. We have a vacancy. You're appointed. I went in there. I looked at it. And certainly the books were as bad as he said. Mm-hmm. So we called all the heads of all the departments in. And we said, every one of you within 2 weeks has to come to me with a revised budget. Each of those budgets have to have a 10% real reduction in expense. We figured if we could do that, we could somehow get enough money together where we could keep vendors that we owed money current on existing orders and pay them anywhere from 5 to 6% of what we owed them in back payments every month with that payment. They came back to me. We did it. We went to the vendors, and other than one or two, they all said, well, at least you're working towards getting us money. We understand your situation. We'll go with it. Within 18 months, we were completely out of debt with those vendors. All right. We were back to square one. We were even, and we didn't have one bill that was more than 30 days delinquent. That's what we need to do with our school district. Hard decisions, goals, measurable goals, and hold people's feet to the fire.
So with the finances here, is it in a really bad shape, or is it something like you said, if we start working on it now, it can be fixed as far as the finances and the budget goes?
The school district budget, all right, the indebtedness of the school district is 64% the total indebtedness of the total county. Now you figure the county, all the hospitals, all the roads, all the different departments, and yet the school district holds 64% of the debt. That's because in the past, nobody asked how we're going to pay for new programs. They just will issue another bond. Well, a bond is a debt obligation where people pay you money but expect interest in return. All right, those bonds can be paid down even though they're not required to be paid down until, let's say, 2035 or 24. They can be paid down anytime we want to. And every time we make a capital reduction in those bonds, that's less interest going out the window. So after 3 years, if we reduce that indebtedness by 30%, that means that that's $500,000 to $600,000 that's not going out the window in interest that we can put back into the school district.
Yeah.
All right? Taxes are things that politicians do mm-hmm. because you don't have to think. You don't have to do anything. You just say, okay, we're going to spend more, so you got to pay more. I'm against that 100%. Do taxes go up? I guess they do. I think they go up a lot, you know, quicker and frivolously than they need to. It's because nobody wants to sit. Well, I don't know if they even understand. I don't know if there's anybody on the school board now who even knows how to read a general ledger.
Yeah.
I couldn't tell you. You know, from what I've seen from looking at the books of the school board and from what I've seen with questions that have come up with, you know, building new schools versus rehabbing old schools. I think people just say, well, you need it. Okay, go borrow the money. We'll get it for you. Well, every time you borrow the money, yeah, that's a short-term situation, but you add to the long-term burden.
Yeah.
It's just a non-thinking way of putting a Band-Aid on a problem when the thing you need to do is you need to heal that wound and take that Band-Aid off and go on to another problem to take care of.
So that's some great ideas for a school board. How can people follow you with your campaign and maybe if they like what you're saying, how do they contribute to your campaign? Or well, how, maybe volunteer or sure. financial-wise?
The hardest thing, first of all, when I got into this, it was a nonpartisan race. It became a partisan race about a month after I declared my candidacy, and I go, oh my goodness, no. And even though I was running as a conservative Republican anyway, that meant that all of a sudden, rather than running in August in one election, I have a primary in May. So the first thing I have to do is I have to win the primary in May, okay. All right? And the best way I could win the primary in May is to meet as many people or expose myself and my ideas to as many people as possible so that they know what I stand for. I think they know what the people who are on the school board now stand for. They stand for the status quo. I do not, all right? The best way they can do right now is I have signs up. You know, I'm the pro-parent Republican, all right? On there is a website. The one thing in my campaign that is not going the way I thought was my website creation. I've got people there who promised me that it would be ready by the middle of December. It's not. I'm hoping to have it ready within 2 or 3 weeks. Based upon my experience with them in the past, I can't guarantee that would happen. So the best way to follow me would be to go one of my two websites, my Facebook pages, Facebook Doug Ibbotson, which is my personal website, or Doug Ibbotson for School District, which is my campaign website.
How do you spell your last name?
IBBETSON.
Okay.
When my website is up and running, I will announce it. I'll probably, you'll have a plane going across, you know, skywriting it, because I will be so happy to have it up. But as of right now, if you go there, it's just going to say it's not active.
Yeah.
The best way to contact me is through my Facebook page.
Okay.
And by doing that, you can go there, you can find out about me, you can volunteer. I'm going to need people to help knock on doors. I'm going to need people to help with mailings. I'm going to need people to help make calls. I've got a great crew out putting up signs. A lot of people have said they've seen a lot of my signs up.
Yep.
So that, but there's always need for people, especially as we get into the
heat of the season.
Absolutely. I'm going to be out knocking on doors, doing interviews like this, meeting with people, and I'm going to need people to back up. I have a wonderful campaign director called Levin. She is getting all of the volunteer requests that come in. You can put a sign, you can request a yard sign, all right? You can request information from me and we'll get it to you. I'm going to start ads in the Jefferson County Post, the Standard Banner, on the radio station.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll be hearing from me that way. The hardest thing for me to do is to ask for money.
Sure.
I absolutely hate asking for money, but signs and things do cost money, and gas costs money. All right? I don't believe in people putting their credit cards online. So if you want to donate to me, I would really appreciate it. You can write a check out to Doug Ibbotson or Doug Ibbotson for School Board and send it to P.O. Box 33, Dandridge, Tennessee, 37725. All right. So I am accepting, but again, it's not something you're going to hear me make a big deal of. I've been blessed, and even though I could use the money, I know money is tight these days.
Okay.
So that's the best way. When my website gets up and running, everybody will know it's not up and running now. The best way to get to me is through Facebook.
And I can link that on the podcast thing.
Wonderful.
So that'd be good. Well, I appreciate you talking with me, and it's been a pleasure, and I'm sure we'll talk again soon.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Michelle.
So I hope you learned a little bit about Mr. Ibbotson and his campaign and his ideas for the school system, the running for school board, and hope that helps you out. As always, at the end of my podcast, I always like to read and bring to you information, true things and stories about our great American history. And if you haven't followed me before, I use a lot of resources from wallbuilders.com. What a fabulous website for history. If you love history and want to know things that maybe you've never learned before, because I don't know, I don't think we're teaching our kids this much anymore in school. And it's a father-son team, David and Tim Barton. And I had the pleasure of interviewing Mr. Tim Barton in the summer of 2020. And you can go and look on my website for that interview. But they are the largest private collectors of historical documents. They have over 100,000 items of things from history. It's really fascinating to listen to them. They're very knowledgeable. They teach the Constitution all over the United States. And they're really, really great people to listen to and get good information from, truthful information. So they have published a Founders Bible. And I highly recommend that if you love history and you love the Bible, that you get the Founders Bible from their website, wallbuilders.com, because they fill that Bible with little tidbits of history that kind of go along and correlate to different scriptures. So today I'm going to read from the scripture, Proverbs 1:7. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom and instruction. So in that, the key to all knowledge. This verse affirms that all knowledge begins with the fear of the Lord, but for some inexplicable reason, many Christians today interpret it as applying only to spiritual knowledge. While this aspect of knowledge is certainly included, the verse does not confine itself only to that area. It says knowledge, period. Strikingly, for nearly four centuries, Americans believed that the fear of the Lord was the beginning of academic knowledge. For instance, America's first college, Harvard, was established in 1636. And its rules declared this. And you probably listening about what Harvard is like today, probably go, what? Here's what it said. Let every student be plainly instructed and earnestly pressed to consider well the main end of his life and studies is to know God and Jesus Christ, which is eternal life. From John 17:3. And therefore, to lay Christ in the bottom as the only foundation of all sound knowledge and learning. And seeing the Lord only giveth wisdom, let everyone seriously set himself by prayer in secret to seek it of him, as in Proverbs 2:3. Everyone shall so exercise himself in reading the scriptures twice a day that he shall be ready to give such an account of his proficiency therein. In 1642, America's first public education law was passed. It was called the Old Deluder's Satan Law, which explained this. It being one chief project of that old deluder, Satan, to keep men from the knowledge of the scriptures as in former times. In 1690, America's first public school textbook was published, the New England Primer, reprinted frequently for the next 2.5 centuries. It was a common text from which American students learned to read. Prominent in this first grade textbook was the rhyming alphabet. Oh, and back to the old deluder Satan law, the reason they put that in there is because they were coming from Europe and from being persecuted from other, you know, for their religious beliefs. And the church leaders at that time, it's Middle Ages, Dark Ages, if you want to call it that. The people, all of the services, church services were in Latin. The people didn't know Latin, so they had to rely on the preachers and the pastors and the reverends and the priests to tell them what the scripture said. So for many, many years, a long time, people didn't read the Bible. They only listened to what the priests told them or the preachers told them were in the Bible, was in the Bible. So they could only understand it from what they were told. And then this old deluder Satan law was a requirement that everyone here learn to read, because that way they could be independent and could read the Bible for themselves, and they would have a very moral foundation to live their lives. That's pretty fascinating. I didn't know that until I started learning all this the last couple years. So the first grade textbook was the rhyming alphabet, and for example, the ABC. So A was, in Adam's fall we sinned all. B, heaven to find the Bible mind. C, Christ crucified for sinners died. And so forth. The whole alphabet is like that. It also contained more than 100 questions, this primer, this first grade, including one such as this. And see if you can answer any of these. Which is the fifth commandment? What is required in the fifth commandment? What is forbidden in the fifth commandment? What is the reason annexed to the fifth commandment? Whoa. In 1779, when chiefs from the Delaware Indian tribe brought George Washington 3 youths to be trained in American schools, Washington reaffirmed that the fear of the Lord was still central to American education. Commending the chiefs for their decision, he told them this: "You do well to wish to learn our arts and way of life, and above all, the religion of Jesus Christ. These will make you a greater and happier people than you are. Congress will do everything they can to assist you in this wise intention." By George Washington's own words, what youth learned in America's schools, above all, was the religion of Jesus Christ, that is, the fear of the Lord. In 1789, the first federal law to address education was passed by Congress. Signed by President George Washington, Article 3 of that law directly linked religion and public education together, declaring this: religion, morality, and knowledge, being necessary to good government and the happiness of mankind, schools and the means of education shall forever be encouraged. The founders believed, and in this first federal education law acknowledged, that schools and education systems were a proper means to encourage the, quote, religion, morality, and knowledge, end quote, that were so necessary to good government and the happiness of mankind. This philosophy of education continued well into the 20th century, a fact demonstrated by courses taught in public schools in Dallas, Indianapolis, St. Louis, Little Rock, and other districts across the nation. Those courses, like a Bible study course of the Old Testament and a Bible study course of the New Testament, counted toward graduation in those schools. Lesson 1 in the New Testament course begins by having students read John 1, and then answer questions such as this: where was Christ before he was born on earth? What titles does John apply to Christ in this chapter? For what purpose was John sent by God? Name 5 things the angel told Mary concerning her child Jesus. What does the word Jesus mean? Why is this no longer the practice today? Because in 1962 and 1963, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that after 320 years of the fear of the Lord being central to America's educational philosophy, it was time to make a change. That it was time for public education to become completely secular. The difference between the two approaches has been dramatic and measurable. For example, following the introduction of the new educational policy, including the fear of the Lord, academic knowledge plummeted, evidenced by the dramatic decline in the college-bound student SAT scores. Furthermore, in numerous recent international academic competitions, American high school students regularly finished last, near the last, or in the bottom half of the students in math and science testing. In fact, one recent international testing found that although American elementary students performed above average when compared with their peers in other nations, junior high students performed only at average, and American high school students finished at the bottom, well below average. This sequence of results prompted one national education magazine to observe the following. Quote, the longer U.S. students stay in school, the less they seem to know, end quote. Another measurement reflecting the change is that of illiteracy. Only a few decades ago, America had one of the world's highest literacy rates, but it now ranks a dismal 65th in the world among its nearly 200 nations, and a number of third world nations currently post higher literacy rates than the United States. Yet, on the other hand, testing results routinely demonstrate that students who participate in faith-based education, whether in the home, Christian, or parochial schools, score several grade levels higher than their counterparts in public schools on the same academic tests, regardless of demographic locations or socioeconomic status. And those students also score 40 points or more higher on the college-bound SAT test. The American educational system is indeed learning from harsh experience that the scriptures are accurate and that the fear of the Lord is indeed the beginning of knowledge, including academic knowledge. So, that's why it's important for parents to be involved, to have, you know, this whole foundation that our country was founded on is a biblical foundation. And we're not taught that. That is eliminated from our history classes nowadays. And it's just part of the fabric of our nation. And when we don't know it, we don't teach it, we don't learn it. So, like the stats show us, things go downhill. So hopefully you'll keep, this information. Maybe once you, maybe kind of, get you interested in learning some more history. I highly recommend wallbuilders.com. And then, of course, all of my episodes, if you want to go back to listen to any of them, I end them with little tidbits of history like that, and even some stories of individual people that did, you know, extraordinary things from ordinary people. So it's all up to us. We are all to be involved, to get involved, and to be active citizens, to keep our country free, and we see what's happening right now, and we do that at the local level. So hopefully you learned a little bit about Mr. Ibbotson, and you can follow him on Facebook. I will put that link in the podcast, my website there, and hopefully I'll be getting to talk to a couple more people along the way in the next few weeks. But again, you can follow me at straighttalkwithmj.net, and thanks again for listening, and we will talk again soon.